Future-Proof Extra from News Talk.
Now, if you're a regular listener to the show, you'll know I'm a bit of a geek for perception and how we make sense of the world. And so really excited to speak to our next guest, Adam Rogers. He's a senior correspondent in Wired, and he's a new book out called Full Spectrum, How the Science of Colour Made Us Modern. And it's a really interesting book because it goes into colour, which is so fascinating in and of itself, how we perceive it, but also how we make it. He joins me now. Adam, when we think of light, we often think of visible light. You know, the Richard of York gave Battle in Vain, that comes the back end of a prism. But light is this continuum of frequencies, right? From where does it start and where does it end?
Yeah, wow. That's right. You're talking about the kind of the whole electromagnetic spectrum, which for human beings, there are a lot of ways to do the quantification here, but one way is to describe the wavelengths in terms of nanometers, billionths of a meter, right? And these are oscillations in electromagnetic fields. So waves in what is a big question. You sort of have to not think too hard about that. But what humans perceive as visible light is like between 480 and 750 nanometers, which doesn't really matter for these purposes, except to say that the longer ones are reddish and the shorter ones are bluish. And as you get longer and longer, the reddish ones turn into infrared, which is heat. The shorter ones turn into ultraviolet, which will give you a tan and then will give you cancer, and then turn into ionizing radiation. And then you've got stuff like gamma rays that don't turn you into the Incredible Hulk, but are like things that people think of as being mutating radiation. So there's a long stretch, if you look at the graphics of this, of things that like cosmic rays at one end and heat at the other. And we just perceive this little tiny slice.
And that slice is very interesting because we think about the visible light just being that red to violet, but we see a little bit into the rest of the spectrum, right? The colors that we see go beyond that. For example, sort of fluorescent markers and stuff.
Right, we absolutely do. And the reason for that is that even though we still talk about the receptors that perceive color in the eye as being red, green, or blue, or short, medium, and long wavelengths, they're really peaks. They have a peak at those wavelengths, and then they kind of have tails that spread out and overlap with each other in some respects. So like the green and blue receptors overlapping each other is how you can see a yellow, for example. And that blue one does stretch out a little bit into the near ultraviolet. And of course, the visible spectrum is different for different animals that have slightly different variations in the kind of receptors that they have. So birds and insects see quite well into the ultraviolet. Some reptiles can perceive into the infrared. So their idea of color is very different than ours. They're still seeing colors, but they're seeing not just, in some cases, finer gradations within what humans would think of as the visible spectrum, but also more colors out on the tails.
There are, of course, animals that can see billions of times more colors than we can. The mantis shrimp, I think we've talked about on the program at one stage, that has this factor of, I don't know, 50 versus what we can see. But there are some humans that can see not just with three red, green, and blue, but with a fourth corner to this color, right? What are they called?
Tetrachromats. If you and I are color normal, we are trichromats. We have trichromatic vision. The mantis shrimp that you mentioned is a dodecachromat. They have 12 color receptors. There's some question about whether the mantis shrimp uses those to actually see more colors than humans do, because their brains are wired. Those receptors are actually wired much more directly to what mantis shrimp have for a brain than our photoreceptors are. So it may be that they're doing that for speed, that what they get is they can respond faster, which is good because mantis shrimp also have like a superpowered high-speed punch that they kill prey with. So it's really good for them to be able to see fast. There's theory. The data here is not great, but that some humans have a mutation that gives them a fourth photoreceptor that makes them tetrachromats. It's probably somewhere in the blue and green that would again let them see. If you and I presented with the same blue, presented with two different blues, that they would be able to see as different. You and I might see them as the same. And
it's
the,
kind of
the,
a lame superpower, really.
This is right. I guess that's right. And the way that you would test it too is you should be able to have metamers of yellow, that would be the same yellow that you and I would think were yellow, and they would see as like, well, that one's yellow and that one's greenish or something like that.
In the book, you also, I mean, you talk about perception and how we see in the history of how we figured out how the brain perceives color. But you also talk about this molecule, titanium dioxide, and you sort of geek out a bit on it in the book. Can you tell me why this particular molecule is so important and a little bit about how we make color today?
Sure. Right. I'll try to make the case. I have to admit, I don't know if everybody shares the same obsession as I do. But I am fascinated by this. So, titanium dioxide has, when purified, a incredibly high refractive index. And when you're making a pigment, what really matters, in addition to how the fundamental material interacts with light, is the size of the particle. Size of a particle will also how it refracts light back and how organized that refraction is, basically. So if you want something to be white, what you want is particles of a specific size that are refracting, reflecting and refracting light across the spectrum in a disorganized way in all directions. And that'll give you a white. And titanium dioxide, it turns out, is really, really good at that. Now, before titanium dioxide was kind of invented as a pigment, which happened in the late 19th, very early 20th century, the main white pigment was lead white, had been for thousands of years, probably invented in Rome. Lead white also has a very high refractive index. It does the same kind of physical and chemical stuff that titanium dioxide does. It also is unbelievably toxic. It's toxic to make, it's toxic to have. Lead's a potent neurotoxin, all the same problems that people understand about lead from lead paint and leaded gasoline. So by the early 20th century, it was pretty clear that this stuff was harming or killing the people who made it, and also potentially the people who had, you know, lead paint in their homes. There was some demand for a replacement. A metallurgist named Auguste Rossi had gotten very good at understanding alloys of titanium and iron, because he was doing mining work in the Adirondacks, and he was trying to create a new titaniferous alloy, a steel that could be used in rails. To do that, he went to Niagara Falls, which was a hotbed of innovation because there was enough electrical power to do electrical chemistry there. And while he was there, he kind of accidentally discovered in his purification process for this alloy that he was getting this white powder that could be used as a pigment.
Okay, so this titanium dioxide particle reflects and refracts light in all different colors. What is it that we do on the sort of nanoscale when we mix that with something else, that it all of a sudden gives us a really bright blue or a pale yellow? Or what exactly is going on there with the light that was going all over the place?
Well, so there's a lot of in the early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century, the number of artificial pigments available to human beings kind of doubled. And until that point, what people had done is gone out into the natural world and found stuff that already had color, and essentially tried to grind it up into a particle size that would still retain the colored properties that they wanted, but also they could combine it with, you know, something sticky that would hold it together, and they could apply it to a surface, basically. And those materials can be anything from the ochres, like iron oxides, like in rust, or that you would find out in a desert, through grinding up gemstones, through something like lapis lazuli or malachite that has copper in it to make a green. And you know, the competition to create these new colors was a driving economic force since the turn of the millennium. So, for example, the Egyptians created something called Egyptian blue that they made by basically cooking sand with some of the minerals that they had access to. By the 500s, the competitor to that was Han or Chinese blue, because they also had some materials that they could make a blue out of, both very persistent blues. And the competition on the Silk Road between the Arabs and the Chinese to who had the best blue was part of what drove that economy for 1,000 years.
But what's happening? I know by using this, where you're absorbing some of the light and reflecting it. But I don't understand how our eyes, because there are so many photons coming from so many reflective surfaces, I don't understand how we perceive any color at all, because we're getting so much in. How does that work?
Right. So the photons are interacting with surfaces and other materials. And sometimes that interaction is happening with the outsides of the atoms. And sometimes that interaction is happening because of the actual shape of the substance at the nanoscale. You know, in bird and butterfly wings, those are structural colors. It's not just the pigment, but the actual shapes are doing stuff to redirect the photons, and some redirecting some photons and toward the eye and others away from the eye. So what the eye is able to do is capture and sort of sort which photons are coming in at once. It's doing something called quantum catch. So we can see in different, if you break down the eye into what are called receptive fields, like different receptors are responsible for different parts of the field of vision that we see. And they'll sum up the information that they're collecting. So as you get further and further back along the kind of neural chain into the brain, and this is still like, this is one of those things that people who study it will still fight about how it actually works, because there are a few synapses that they can find and some parts of the brain that are just hard to study. What the brain will do is say, okay, well now I'm seeing green, let's say, in that part of my vision, and I'm not seeing red around it. So I'm a neuron that's going to fire right now and talk to the neurons next to me. And the other one will be saying, well, I'm seeing blue in the middle, but not, and yellow in the outside, so I'm not going to fire. And I'm going to tell that information to the neurons next to me. So we're able to do that both in specific regions that we see, like specific areas that we're looking at in front of us, and then also what colors we're seeing and how much of that color we're seeing in that area. Hmm. And that calculation is going on all the time.
I believe we're still making new colors. And that kind of seems weird to me. I mean, not only because I'm currently painting our shed and it seems like every color under the sun is available, it's very hard to pick one. But how is it possible that we are making new colors still? I saw Crayola made one recently. How is that possible? And why is that a big deal?
Well, often it's an accident. A chemist will come across a color in a different without knowing that's what they're working on. So like the Crayola one that they just announced I think you might be thinking of Yinmin blue, which was a blue made of, let's see if I remember, yttrium, indium, and manganese cooked together in just the right way, coming up with a bright new blue. And that's an interesting story, because the same researchers have been trying to figure out through the process that they came up with Yinmin blue to figure out, well, can they make a red also? Because if you can get a new red, that would be great. People would love that if there would be a new red. It's really hard to make bright reds, it turns out. You can make dark, crummy reds like ochre, but if you want a Ferrari red, you know, if you want like that bright red, a new one of those that was also durable would be great. And they haven't been able to make a red. It's interesting also the language there to say like we make new colors, because of course there's a universe of possible colors based on the physics alone. And then there's kind of the gamut of colors that the human eye can perceive, and you can map that over it, and it's slightly less than the possible colors, I suppose. And then there's the gamuts that you could map of like what your computer screen is able to synthesize and generate and emit, or what paints are able to come up with.
Am I right in saying that the computer screen that we have can show us all the colors, we just don't necessarily perceive all of them?
No, your computer screen, even if you have a great color calibrated, ultra high definition, wide color gamut screen, still doesn't show you all the colors that your eye can perceive. It's getting pretty close. The overlap's pretty good.
If you're on Twitter, you can have a look at some of my favorite visual illusions, actually, which will blow your mind. I use them in talks for kids during Science Week. You can check it out at News Talk Science, and it will start getting you thinking, as this book does, about how, like everything, light and color don't really exist. Our brains piece them together, and we're very grateful to them for that. Adam Rogers, author of Full Spectrum, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's a great topic.